foot is sweeter than my sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. Today I'll be reading excerpts from Eno Journal, Volume 10, Number 1, Ribbons of Color Along the Eno River. The History of African Americans and People of Color Living on the Eno. The Executive Director of the Eno River Association, Jessica Sheffield, writes this introduction. Eno River journals have been published intermittently since the spring of 1973 as a special gift from the Eno River Association to our membership. Dormant since 2000, we are thrilled to be reviving the Eno River Journal for you during Black History Month 2021. For more than 55 years, the association has worked to conserve and protect the natural, historical, and cultural resources of the Eno River Basin. Conservation, at its core, is the celebration of diversity, diversity of plants, diversity of animals, diversity of landscapes, and diversity of cultures and people. To truly live this mission, we must uplift the untold marginalized stories and work to overcome the injustices that have been wrought on the Black and Indigenous communities in our watershed. This volume of our journal is presented in that spirit. Ribbons of Color Along the Eno River contains first and second-hand stories of those who have long lived in the Eno watershed. It has been a distinct pleasure and a learning experience for the Eno River Association to work with authors, especially Beverly A. Scarlett, to assemble this collection. Out of respect to the many contributors, honoring the voice of each individual author, the journal uses colloquial expressions, various preferences of capitalization, and other stylistic variations that you may notice. We at the Eno River Association hope you'll enjoy these rich voices of family history and historical events that connect people of color to the Eno River Valley. Beverly A. Scarlett writes in the dedication, "This volume of the Eno River Journal is about, and dedicated to, African Americans, people of color, and communities of color along the Eno River. Many of our families have lived quietly in areas bounded by the river, enjoying stories shared by our parents and other family members. Seldom do we take the time to journal or otherwise chronicle our own history. Fear of a horrible story of a slave being beaten, sold, or murdered can lead to a sense of paralysis, making it easier for us to abandon the pen. Therefore, African American life is most often documented by white people. While much of their work is appreciated, it does not capture the uniqueness or richness of our lives. Once I was asked by a well-learned professional why very fair-complexioned African Americans do not, quote, just become white. I gladly reported that our culture creates a tie that binds, and once you leave, there is no coming back. It is noteworthy that some African Americans did cross over, leaving behind families, memories, and the richness of their culture. Although African Americans and people of color were and are systematically disenfranchised, we view life through a different lens. We have the ability to find humor in hardship and creativity from castaways. Our lives are complex and complicated, yet we manage to survive, prosper, and often find success. Our lives are as rich as a bowl of Rougemont's finest Brunswick stew, having many different ingredients, yet filled with flavor. Why shouldn't we share our voices using our words? In this neophyte volume of Ribbons of Color Along the Eno River, I will share the stories of my family and community as told to me by my parents and relatives. I will share first-hand accounts of others whose lives have been enriched by the flowing waters of the Eno. Each story is authored by one who has an Eno River heritage or connection, or the story features one who is connected to the Eno River. Many of the stories you will read showcase unsung heroes. Other stories will shock the conscience, reminding us that such history should not repeat itself, nor should it have a place in civilized society. It is my wish that more people of color will find the strength to share their stories and enjoy the power obtained from finding your voice and welcoming community interest in your story. History is simply what the word conveys. His story, and importantly, her story. We all have a story, so let us share our individual journeys. The journal begins with several detailed historical chapters, including a chapter on the Okinichi Band of the Siponi Nation by Lawrence A. Dunmore III, Esquire, a chapter on African Americans responding to the end of enslavement by Dr. Freddie Parker, and a chapter on the history of the Scarlett family, an African American family living along the Eno River, by Beverly A. Scarlett. In keeping with Triangle Yesteryear's tradition of first-person stories, we'll start with what John Scarlett, who lived from 1920 to 2010, told interviewer Joe Lyles at the home of Beverly A. Scarlett on the site of the original Scarlett homestead in October of 2003. Now, I don't want to make any false statements in this interview because I'm so near to the finishing line. I was born March 1, 1920. I was born in the cabin that still stands over there. My father was William Green Scarlett. He was nicknamed Bud Chris. He built this cabin many years before I was born and moved his wife Lula into it. She helped build the back part of it. My father was an old man when I was born. I was the 10th child. Two more came after me. We only had lamplight in that cabin, and we only had wood heat. We had a fireplace in the kitchen with a wood-fired cook stove over to the side. We had a fireplace in the master bedroom, and we had a wood heater in the front room. We had kerosene lamps and lanterns. There was never electricity in that house. We never had no radio until I went into the military in 42. I took the radio out of my 1935 Ford and the battery out, and sat it in the house so my mother could play it and get her music. The kitchen was separate. It was set off from the other parts. We made a dining room by connecting the kitchen to the rest of the house with German siding. It was a two-bedroom log cabin. My father farmed here at this place. He sold some land and ended up buying some land up there off of Linden Road. We would farm up there. We would go to Wardsville School. On beautiful days, we would go to school half a day, then walk down University Station Road, where it linked to Linden Road in the vicinity of Highway 70, and we would work on the farm till dark, come home by lantern light, go by the power plant, lantern on the wagon, and we'd be ready for another day. We had plenty of food, but no money much, and every kind of patch on our clothes but a turnip patch. I can't call my first teacher's name right now, but they taught us reading, writing, arithmetic, English, geography, history, basics. My last teacher was Lula Fincher. I was 12 years old when I stopped going to school. I finished my 7th grade. The teacher used the blackboard to teach us. We were permitted to go out in the yard at recess. And there were hickory trees. When we would go out for lunch, we would get a bunch of scaly bark or hickory nuts and crack 'em and put 'em in our pockets. And when the teacher weren't looking, we'd eat 'em. We had to take our lunch, such as what we had to eat. We had plenty of food. Whatever Mother fixed, she'd fix it for lunch. We had dried peas. We'd have meats, and I know we would have a biscuit or two, and pear preserves. We had whatever was available. In the spring of the year, when the weather was good, she'd fix the lunch basket, and we'd get our lunch after we left school, when we got to the farm. We'd eat our lunch there, and then we would work to the edge of dark and go back home by the lantern light. When I was a boy, I would carry messages down the Fish Dam Road, just after it became inactive. The bridge over Stones Creek was out, but I used the foot log. I would get on my hands and knees to go across that log so I wouldn't fall in the creek. I was carrying messages to a man that lived on the other side of that cooling pond of the power plant. The messages were from Mr. Bob Griffin. Most of the messages were about what time to come to work. I thought these messages were about farming. When I found out that these messages were about making moonshine whiskey, I didn't care. 50 cents was a lot of money back then. I was real careful when I was down there around that foot log. And it wasn't just about falling in the creek. You see, a man got killed near there, and I was looking for a haint. That man worked for the power plant. He drove a dinky train to load the coal that they used to heat the water. They had a big engine that would bring the coal cars in to the power plant. It would make 2 trips from the university station to the plant most days. The dinky was a little shift engine that would shift the cars around from the loading ramp to the train after they were emptied. The dinky would be running down the track. This man went to catch it, but he didn't get on it real good, and he fell up under it, and it killed him. It happened just the other side of Pleasant Green Road. I would be thinking about a haint when I would go by there. For entertainment, we'd play the Victrola. We'd play a little baseball, yard or home baseball, you know. Or Annie Over, throwing the ball over the house. We would set fish hooks down at the Eno River. We'd go to the hooks in the morning and take what fish we'd caught that night, and we'd cook 'em. We survived. We'd catch eels, we'd catch suckers, we'd catch catfish, we'd catch perch. We would stick the poles in the ground, wooden poles. We would use worms for bait. We would have what you call hog-killing days. We'd get up early in the morning. We'd put the water in the vat the evening before. Early in the morning, we'd build a fire under there. The water would get scalding hot. 1, 2, 3 dips, and it would be ready to scald. Just barely, you would dip your finger in there. It wouldn't burn you, but it would be so hot you couldn't make another dip. Round daylight or shortly thereafter, we'd go to the hog pen. We would shoot the hog with the rifle. My brother James was the rifleman. My father was mostly the sticking man. He'd stick 'em in the throat and get the blood out. We'd drag one hog out of the pen and take him to the vat. Most of the time we'd have 2, 3, 4 hogs, and sometimes 1 or 2 for the neighbors. And we'd dress 'em. Most of the time we'd have liver for dinner from one of those hogs. Mother and them would be cleaning the chitlins. We had no running water. They would have to take the water and pour it down through the chitlins to get all that stuff out. They'd turn 'em wrong side out to clean 'em. They'd soak 'em so many days in salt water, and then we'd eat them. Late in the afternoon, when it would start to getting cool, my father would cut them hogs up, salt 'em down, and put 'em in the box. Backbone, spare ribs in one box. Ham, shoulders, and middlings in the other box. He'd keep 'em for about 6 weeks, and after that he would wash the meat and wash all that excess salt off, hang it up to cure. And that is how we got our country ham. You rub salt on 'em when you first put 'em in the box, but just before you hang 'em up to dry, you'd rub pepper and a little sage on 'em. That would give 'em a certain kind of taste and help keep the skippers out. Oh, a skipper is a little worm. He's not a maggot, but he's a little worm that gets in meat. He is something to destroy your meat. He didn't have no kind of legs. I reckon he would ball up some kind of way, and he would hop and pop when you would lay those hams out in the sun. The only thing you would throw away would be the hair and the hoofs. We'd keep the feet, the snout, the ears, all that. Nothing wasted but the hair and the hoofs. Sometimes they'd take some of the hoofs and boil 'em to get hogfoot oil. That's what you would rub your children in when they would get a cold or something or another. You'd rub it on their chests. My grandfather, Levi Scarlett, was dead before I was born. I was told about how he acquired the property and told where he was buried at. That's about as much as I know. Levi was a slave to the Scarletts. I reckon that's how he got his name. There was 2 of these women that he had taken care of until they died. These women willed him a certain amount of property in this area right here. Now, the power plant that was close to here was run by Duke Power. There was a village along with the plant. On the left side of Fish Dam Road, there was a village that had 6 houses. They had a boarding house, the superintendent's house, and 4 employee houses. Down a little nearer to the creek, it had 4 houses that the black employees, the ones that merited a home, lived in. Right where the current entrance is, on Pleasant Green Road, there was 4 houses in there. Over across the other side of the pond, there was 4 there. There was 18 houses in all. It was a steam plant. The train would bring coal. They had a great big pile of coal. They had a cable that ran from an electric winch, and they would pull the coal up to the top of that coal pile, up to where the crane could get it, and drop it in the bin. They fired the plant with coal and had a cinder pit under there. You had to dump the cinders into a buggy and dump 'em in that pit of water to cool 'em down, and then they would take the cinders out. They had a turbine that turned to make electricity. When the water would get hot, they would run it out to the spray pond, and that would cool it off. Then they would recycle it. That's why the dam is down there in the Eno River, to keep water dammed up so they could cool the turbine to make electricity. That's about the way it was set up, as best I can tell y'all. I worked there a few months before I went into the Army. My job was pulling those hot ashes out of those hot fireboxes. It was hot work, but it was also wet work. You was standing in water most of the time. It was dangerous work. Thomas McBroom was hurt there. Somebody dumped on him when he was back in the hole. They dumped those hot coals on him. He got burned bad. I went off to the military on May 21st, 1942. I was 22 years old. We stayed on Fort Bragg about 10 months getting our basic training. We shipped out to Fort Dix, New Jersey, in March of 1943. We left Fort Dix for we didn't know where, but we boarded the ship that night at Pier B of Staten Island, New York. We sailed for 13 days and nights on a British ship that was named Stirling Castle. We landed in Oran, Africa, on April 12, 1943. We stayed in Africa maybe 10 months, and we went from there into Italy. We stayed there and built fortifications for training people for the invasion of southern France. We followed behind the invasion into southern France and went all the way up through Luxembourg, Belgium, and then to Germany across the Rhine River, and ended up in Gipperkan, Germany. We left Gipperkan in August of 45 and came back to a staging area in France. We left France and landed in Boston, Massachusetts. Left Boston and came back to Fort Bragg, and I was discharged the Friday after Thanksgiving. Coming back here after all that was like a bird got out of a cage. Oh, I felt free. Somebody asked me if I ever got scared over there, and I told him no. Nah. I told him the truth, because the only time I got scared was when I found out I was on the ship out in the ocean. When we woke up on April the 1st, we couldn't see no land nowhere. They pulled out in the night. I got scared then. I didn't really get over it until I got back on this side. You see, I really didn't get scared over there. I got scared on the ocean going over. Now over there you would have some moments where you'd be a little relaxed. But you was over there and can't speak those folks' language, and you don't know who your friend is and who your enemies are. It's just a fearful feeling to be in a war zone. Our officers were white, and all of us soldiers were black. We had some dealings with white units. We had to get along. We had no choice. Sir, when you get far from home, you can get along with a snake if you pull the teeth out. My dad died before I went into the military. He died when I was 18. My mother was still living in the cabin when I came home. I went to work for Liggett and Myers, and I bought a barrack when they was dismantling Camp Butner. And I used the barrack material to build Mother's house up here. We dismantled it over in Butner, and brought it home, and salvaged what was good. I downsized the windows and whatnot. I got a lot of good experience in engineering doing this. We couldn't buy the new materials right after the war. I had a right nice home up there. I paid $600 for that barrack. My mother moved into that house in 1946 or 47. Well, now I'm so old I can't outrun nobody. I can't whoop nobody. So I have to be nice to everybody. That's a good philosophy. I wish I could have learned it 40 years earlier. Epilogue by Beverly A. Scarlett. I learned the most about my father's military service during this interview. Dad would never talk to us about his military service, other than to say he was in the Army during World War II, and he told us of the various countries toured. Dad took pride in speaking a little French, a little German, and a little Italian. Otherwise, Dad's military service was a big secret. It wasn't until December 24, 2010, when my sister Yolanda and I were at Scarborough and Hargett Memorial Chapel planning Dad's funeral that we had one inkling about what Dad really did serving in the United States Army. While planning the funeral, we asked for military rights. Mr. J.C. Skeepy Scarborough III, owner of the business, kindly responded that he would need proof that Dad was in the military. Yolanda remembered Dad had a military card in his wallet. Yolanda reached in her purse and pulled out Dad's wallet. Out of the wallet came a yellowed plastic card in the shape of a U. Dad carried the card in his hip pocket for so long that the card had taken on the shape of his left buttock. Yolanda started reading the microscopic print. Company B, 384th Engineering Battalion. Sergeant. MPME, which means Professional Military Education. EAMET, or Europe, Africa, Middle East, Campaign Medal, with 3 bronze stars. Good Conduct Medal, AR 600-68. Victory Medal. Foreman Construction. No time lost under AW-107. Lapel button issued. ASR score 84. 2nd September, 45. 84 out of a total score of 85. Yolanda and I sat there stunned as Mr. Scarborough appeared to be impressed. Then it dawned on us. The trunk. On Christmas Day, we returned to our childhood home to mourn Dad's transition and to try to have a decent holiday celebration. Christmas Day was Dad's favorite holiday and the only time that he would go out of his way for us when we were children. For Dad, Christmas Day had to be special. Remembering the trunk, Yolanda and I sent our husbands to the attic to bring the trunk down. When we were children, Dad had told us that he had a trunk in the attic and that we, quote, better not go into that trunk. He never divulged the contents of the trunk, but we clearly understood that death was certain should we violate that one command. In 2010, I was still a bit of a skeptic, but Yolanda said, what's he going to do? We sent my younger sister Jackie to locate the key. Of Dad's numerous keys to tractors, mowers, multiple locks, sheds, this, that, and the other, the first key Jackie tried worked. Mom, Yolanda, and I stared as Jackie lifted the top. There they were, lots of medals and other artifacts that we never had a chance to ask Dad about and find out what he did in particular to earn each one. I'm sad that I never had the opportunity to hear the stories surrounding each medal, but I do know that 157 years from the day that Levi Christmas Scarlet was born on the banks of the Eno River, we celebrated a World War II hero, my dad, Christmas Scarlet's grandson. Love you, Dad. Here's to you, Mr. Washington, by Paige Scarlet Hathaway, Episcopal High School, 2018, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, 2022. A champion for juvenile rights living along the Eno. Growing up, I heard many spectacular stories about the famous Johnny Washington. However, it was not until I was about 9 that I actually met him. The stories I heard as a young girl were far better than those of superheroes and superficial characters, because these stories were about a real person doing miraculous things, and, to put the icing on the cake, I am related to him. Johnny Washington was born in 1921, blind and hearing impaired. During adulthood, he became deaf. According to the News and Observer, he was abandoned at infancy and was discovered in an alley next to his dying mother. Based on family stories, he was one of the first children placed in the Durham County foster care system. He was raised by Granddaddy's first cousin. Johnny and Granddaddy were about the same age, so they grew up like first cousins, which in my family is more like brothers. Growing up, Johnny never felt limited by his inabilities to see or hear, and he operated as anyone else would. The stories I heard growing up included one of Johnny being a boy in grade school. He would walk down the long driveway from his house to the end of Russell Road to check the mail. Russell Road is just north of the Eno River, between Umstead and Guess Roads. It's noteworthy that Johnny's parents' home was on the top of a hill located near the middle of the entire length of Russell Road in Durham. As a little girl, this story shook me. I often wondered, how was this safe? Why would his parents let him do this? I was often amazed by his courage and tenacity to do tasks like this. Even as a 20-year-old, I get fearful checking the mail. I'm afraid I will be hit by a car. My family has stories of Johnny protesting the requirement that he work in the fields while a student at the School for the Deaf and Blind, the present-day Governor Moorhead School in Raleigh. Johnny did not submit to maltreatment, such as working long hours without water breaks. With the assistance of others, he wrote a few letters to the governor of North Carolina and described his work conditions. We don't know if the governor responded directly, but we do know the school decided it was in their best interest to place Johnny in foster care. I'm sure they considered him a troublemaker. Luckily, he left the School for the Deaf and Blind and came directly to my family. While at the School for the Deaf and Blind, Johnny learned the basics of music and learned to play piano. Being told of his ability and his desire to play for the church, Sister Lena Scurlock, missionary, purchased a piano for Mount Gilead Baptist Church, Orange County. Johnny became our church's first piano player, and he assisted in reorganizing the church choir. Granddaddy would drive into Durham and pick Johnny up, and he rehearsed with the choir prior to our church service on the second Sunday of each month. I don't know for sure, but I suspect Johnny was baptized in the Eno River at Fuse Ford. As a child, he attended Mount Gilead with his foster mother, Luvinia Cooper, fondly known as Aunt Beanie. As an adult, he joined Mount Vernon Baptist Church in Durham, though he considered our church his home church. Johnny is interred at Mount Gilead beside his foster mother and father, the only parents he knew. Checking the mail and playing piano are very small, minuscule-sized accomplishments of Johnny. His other accomplishments include graduating from a school of Swedish massage in Chicago, founding, editing, and writing columns for the nation's first magazine in Braille in 1952, now called the Merrick Washington Magazine for the Blind, working as a massage therapist at Durham's YMCA, teaching the adult Sunday school class at Mount Vernon Baptist Church, Durham, being married for 52 years, fathering 3 children, 8 grandchildren, and 18 great-grandchildren. Johnny Washington was a remarkable man, and if you had the chance to meet him, you would agree. I was fortunate to meet Johnny when I was 9 years old during his stay at the Bryan Center in Durham. I was there with my mom visiting Granddaddy when she found out Johnny and Granddaddy were neighbors. Then we began to bring Johnny home-cooked meals, as we did for Granddaddy. When I was first able to talk with Johnny, he was elated that I knew sign language. To talk with him, I would fingerspell what I was trying to say by placing his hand around mine with each letter. He understood me, and we had a good conversation. Next, Johnny met my older cousin, Brandon. Upon meeting Brandon, Johnny put his fingers around Brandon's wrist and told Brandon that he was very tall. This was quite shocking. Johnny was blind and could tell that Brandon was tall and fit. From then on, when my family went to see my granddaddy, we would visit Johnny, too. I did not see Johnny from 2010, when Granddaddy passed, until 2015, when we learned he was at a nursing home in Treyburn. Me and Mom cooked food and went to visit him. He told us how he was not afraid to travel to Chicago alone to learn the art of massage, though he admitted that he was lost most of the time. He also told us that he loved listening to the local musicians play there, and he wished he could have afforded to live there. I am happy he made Durham his home and returned to the Eno Valley. I'm very glad I got to meet him before he passed away. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.